Resources is hereby convened for February 6th, 2003. Welcome to all of you. We appreciate you taking the time to be here today. You should note, as I am wont to do, I am careful to alert everyone to the fact that on the sign-up sheet, if you are signed up to testify on legislation, there, please read the little gray darkened border above where you're going to sign your name, which talks about if you are a government official or a lobbyist, that you are already currently under two ORSs that have to do with truthful and accurate testimony. And if you are a member of the public here to testify, this does not apply to you. However, that doesn't mean that we want you to give us inaccurate or untruthful testimony. And we do this simply because we want to make sure that as legislators, we're making policy decisions based on very accurate information. Because oftentimes that information is used in court to establish legislative intent. So having said that and acknowledging that, we are members. Welcome to you all. We're going to work through three bills today, and it is the chair's intention that we move out House Bill 2260, which is the ODF&W fee increase bill, that we refer it to another committee for continued work in the Ways and Means process. We will hear some additional comments from the Department of Fish and Wildlife as they have prepared some responses to us in regards to some of our questions early on that particular bill. It will be the last bill that we do today, however. We are going to start with opening a public hearing on House Bill 2344. And Ray, you want to tell us a little bit about what this bill does, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2344 directs the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to adopt statewide policies that direct state agencies to immediately begin efforts to harvest burned timber, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, the chair would like to call his co-sponsor on this legislation, actually the author of the legislation, Representative Bob Jensen, to come forward, if you would. And if, Bob, is anyone else you want to sit there with you, please feel okay. Very good. Welcome, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My privilege to be here to testify in front of your committee today, especially on this particular little bill. As the chair will remember, four of us from the legislature visited a burn site in eastern Oregon last summer. It's frequently referred to as the Bridge Creek burn site. Fire, as I'm recalling, was in the summer of 01 and did a substantial acreage there. Some of which was on private land, some of which was on state-owned land, and of that that was on state-owned lands, part of that fell under the jurisdiction of the Parks Department, part of it fell under the jurisdiction of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The problem with what ultimately, as you understand very well, Mr. Chair, with salvage lumbering, logging, is that time is of the essence. This is especially true when we get into pine, which deteriorates at about 50% or maybe slightly less than that, but something approaching that per year after a fire goes through, so that 2 years after, if it's pine logs, the value of the logs has diminished to a point that they may not even in fact be worth enough to a cut to take out. Now, there certainly were many complications that went into this, and it isn't the intention of this legislation or the proposal we're bringing forth to make any accusations about any department or anything that took place with this fire. The intention is instead to be proactive, looking into the future to ensure that events of this nature do not reappear for us in the future. This fire, part of the private land on this fire, was logged almost immediately, profits off of that logging from a couple of the constituents that are in my district indicated that the profits were significant and substantial. At least if I could have had the profits, I would have considered them substantial. It seemed to us, as we looked at these at this issue, if I recall correctly, Mr. Chair, that we have a responsibility as stewards of the resources of the state of Oregon try to use all due diligence to make sure that we maximize at any and every opportunity that we have any profits or returns that we might get from these unfortunate events when we have fires like this. I think Department of Forestry is here. There was no intention as we dealt with this to make any negative or anything about the Forest Practices Act or anything like that. It was merely to look at a situation, get something in statute so that every agency in the state would know that time is of the essence when we're going to do salvage logging. And with that, I would be delighted to answer any questions or try to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Bob. Members, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Krupp, and Representative Jensen. You're amazing to be sitting here today after major heart surgery just 3 weeks ago. You're just incredible. Example for all of us, fighting for the people. So I commend you.
Thank you, Donna, but I couldn't let Representative Krupp hear this bill without my being here to testify for it.
And that's why I scheduled it as early as I did.
I see. Okay. Well, we're going to give you credit for the bill. Seriously, I'm just curious. So now we're talking about the entire salvage program, not just this one Bridge Creek fire, right, in this program?
Representative Nelson, Chair Krupp, yes, we're talking about this in a generic sense. Not the legislators came to it from a specific example, but the example we submit would hold. I submit would hold to other salvage logging operations on state-owned forests in our state. So it is meant to cover all of the above, not just one past event.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, please. Thank you. And this word nexus, I'm used to LexisNexis, but is it used here in this explanation? It says this created a nexus between timber salvage rules under Oregon law and the ESA because...
Representative Nelson, I don't believe that Chair Jensen has had an opportunity to read the staff measure summary that our staff prepared, so he probably is not familiar with the question you're asking.
Oh.
He hasn't seen that summary that uses that word.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering if that's been resolved, the dispute between, you know, who has the right to do this, and I guess maybe we're deciding it's our right. And maybe I should wait for... the Forestry Division to tell us the value of the salvage that we anticipate.
Yeah, I don't have an exact value on the salvage. I think the department is here. They may have an estimated value of the stumpage at this point. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Members, additional questions? Bob, In the legislation, in fact, Ray and I were just chatting about this. We use the word immediately. It says to direct state agencies that own or control forest lands to immediately begin efforts to harvest burned timber so that the economic value of the burned timber is not lost due to delay. should we define the word immediately, or is, do you think that's broadly understood that Department of Administrative Services would write a policy that would direct the state agencies to within a few days or a few hours of a burn event where salvage logging may be appropriate, that they would begin that process?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate very much your question and the possible subtleties of the whole issues of definitions. However, in the English language, there's a, you know, a standard definitions that go with, and I think the definition that you'd find out of Webster's would satisfy, you know, the need for this. I mean, and this is an area of definitions that that I have from my previous life some professional experience and background with. And I recall in an area of anthropology that there's an entire book that was written to define one word, the word being culture. And it's one series of definitions of definitions of definitions. And I'd hope we didn't have to go to that, although I do appreciate very much what you're saying.
Well, thank you, Bob, and I think that was the professor in you coming out. Okay, members, any additional questions of Representative Jensen? Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very kindly for hearing the bill. Look forward to moving it, if you can, forward as soon as we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair would like to call... the chair would like to call Roy Ellicker and Craig to come forward, please. Welcome to you both, and for the record, state your names.
For the record, my name is Craig Ely. I'm the Northeast Regional Manager out of LeGrand for the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Roy Ellicker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we have three state agencies, Mr. Chair, testify about this bill today, but I talked to Ray Kelly earlier and thought perhaps we should go first because the events that precede this bill, as described in your summary, evolved partially out of a fire in Northeast Oregon that involved our Bridge Creek Wildlife Area. Just some brief testimony, Mr. Chair, to the bill itself. Mr. Chair, the only issues we might have with the bill is in the policies that we work together with DAS on. I mean, one of the problems that we would have on a blanket, you know, we should salvage immediately all timber perhaps burned in a fire, is that we have a number of federal requirements on some of our wildlife areas and federal restrictions, federal laws, because some of our wildlife areas are both managed or were originally purchased with federal Pittman-Robertson funds, which are funds from essentially hunting and fishing and sportsmen community. In fact, one of the reasons that the timber is still yet to be salvaged on the Bridge Creek Wildlife Area is because of the federal process we're working through, and as you'll see as part of attachment number 2 in the very back page, it gives a current kind of situation where we're at right now with the salvage. But essentially, the 2 points to the bill, Mr. Chair, is that as long as the rules are written in a manner not inconsistent with the federal policies that we would have to comply with depending on the land ownership, and also acknowledging that, for instance, in a wildlife area, there are probably also other state policies involved, even with burned and downed timber, that are important wildlife habitat, and that's important to a wildlife area. So with those two kind of caveats, I don't think there's nothing that we couldn't sit down with DAS and craft a policy that the bill would foster here.
Roy, why don't you explain to us the issue of, and maybe Craig, you can, because this was kind of the area under your control. Do two things for us here. Explain to us how the use of the federal dollars to purchase that land then puts you under certain federal constraints. Do that first, and then give us the timelines. Give us the history of what happened here at Bridge Creek and why we're coming up on 2 years since that fire, and we haven't been able to achieve logging, or is it salvage logging, mm-hmm. of what timber was left there. So
Mr. Chair, Mike, if we answer number two first, would that be okay? Let's give you the brief history, and I think you could follow along, because it's one of our attachments that you have in front of you. You might follow in a letter dated to Representative Jensen October 24th. You have there, starting on page 2, the chronological sequence of events up through October of 01. And again, that's attachment 1, page 2, letter to Representative Jensen. And I'll let Craig, because he is the regional manager and this area is under his control, walk the committee through kind of a brief history of the fire and the various events, and then the federal constraints.
Okay, very good.
Thank you. As you see, shows there, the fire started in August 12th. It burned about 9 days. We met with the Department of Forestry in October to begin the process to salvage the timber and discuss salvage plans and how we might efficiently go about that. In February, we hired a private consulting firm to put together an assessment plan that described the species that were burned.
Could you state again for the record?
I'm sorry. For the record, Craig Ely with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Northeast Regional Manager. Then in February, we hired the consultant to put together the fire assessment for us. We again consulted once we had that assessment in place with the Department of Forestry again to try to determine how we might approach this and go about it efficiently. We held a meeting there with Representative Croft and Jensen Krieger and Representative Smith and ODF staff and several other people and some contractors to discuss salvage plans and what we had intended. We then had to begin to put together a request for proposals. That's a state process to then advertise for people to come in and accomplish the things that were laid out in the plan itself in terms of the species and the kinds of things we wanted to accomplish. We then began to submit documents to the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Again, as Roy mentioned, that's the linkage for us. We had to, the area was purchased with PR funds at 75-25% cost share or program. PR is the Pittman-Robertson Act, and Pittman-Robertson Act is a funding source that we use for the operations of our wildlife areas and also some wildlife research that we have going on throughout the state. It's about a $5 or $6 million annual program. It varies from year to year. And when we began to submit documents to the federal government or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we began to get feedback that this needed all kinds of additional federal reviews with regard to NOAA Fisheries, which is the old Mass Marine Fisheries Service, and also the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because there were bull trout and steelhead possibly affected by this particular action that we were taking on the ground. In addition to that, we were given what we call a National Environmental Policy Act checklist, or a NEPA checklist. It's what stimulates environmental assessments. You've probably heard that term. Environmental impact statements. In that checklist, we were required to then look at the cultural resources that were possibly on our property, and then again the actions that we were taking on the ground and the possible effect on some of those cultural resources. So we collected bids for cultural resources, and the bids came back extremely high, $22,000 to $24,000. And at that point, I told my staff, I said, those are completely out of line with what I think was acceptable. So we did and were successful in finding somebody that would do it for us for about $3,000. But again, we had to go through that process. The contractor came and did the assessment. Then they have to write a report, turn that into the state historical, it's SHPO is the acronym, Preservation Organization. And then they send us back a letter that concurs that the resources are protected given the description of the actions that we'll take on the ground. And then we go through a contract amendment process with the federal government. And you can see here is all the steps that we're having to take. And that, if you go on to page 3, it kind of completes that process. And I might refer you to attachment 2 that kind of brings us up to date.
Attachment B, and it's this memo dated to myself from January 15, 2003. It's the back page, And that basically aligns where we're at as we have the hearing today, that essentially we've completed the archaeological field work. We sent the heritage report to the SHPO office, and now we have, I believe, all the required paperwork at the Fish and Wildlife Service for a decision by them to allow us to go forward with a logging proposal.
And when do you anticipate hearing back from them? Have they given you a sense of when they may be responding?
Yes, they have. Chair Kropp, it's in the next couple of weeks we anticipate these authorities or these approvals coming back. And I'll have to say I've been equally frustrated with the length of this process and how long it's taken. I've done two other timber sales in the region, and when we began to list fish, all these other processes came into place that began to require that we walk through those requirements for those federal agencies.
Members, questions so far? Representative Hunt.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. In looking back at your memo to Representative Jensen from October, you referenced the possibility of an environmental assessment being required. What is your sense at this point, which would then delay the sale, or delay any salvage operations at the lakes in 2003? What's your sense of where that is?
Chair Kropp, Representative Hunt, based on our review and the information that we supplied to them, it really was to our benefit to get the assessment done by the contractor. That helped a great deal. He identified what we would do. We are not required to do an environmental assessment. They ruled that our action on the ground would not harm the fisheries, the ones that we were concerned about. So that's not a requirement.
In again, reviewing timelines here, and I know that it is somewhat unusual for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to be engaged in having to consider a salvage logging operation, and that because this is not your area of expertise or management, that clearly there were, because of that lack of experience, opportunities for these timelines to stretch out a bit. How can we tighten these up a little further in the future? And would this legislation help achieve that? Because clearly then there would be policies set in place, in my mind anyway, that would be perhaps easier, more clear directing as to when certain things would need to be done. And you're very correct. Any time that you're going to enter into circumstances where you have listed species, that will slow the process down, just for the obvious reasons of having to deal with the federal government and comply with the necessary paperwork. But I'm talking about on terms of our end as the state of Oregon, because we're looking here, the fire started August 12th. It was controlled on the 19th. You met in October of 2001, a month and a half later, 2 months later, whenever, to start talking with the Department of Forestry and BLM about how to do this. And then we go on through February. By the time you had hired Mr. Herbst as your consultant to develop the fire assessment plan, then we get into May of 2002. And this really, it's clear that we get stretched out of here a bit in the initial stages. How can we keep that from occurring again? Should we, hopefully not, but should we be faced with this once again?
Mr. Chair, we try to confer as early and often as need be with Department of Forestry, and we look to the Department of Forestry as the experts in this, even though they haven't usually have to deal with all these federal requirements and restrictions that we did. I guess perhaps maybe I would best answer that by requesting perhaps that we work with forestry on a response to that. I'm not sure, for ourselves, we've learned a lot in our agency about how to more quickly move ahead on a salvage situation. Whether there's this bill passes or not, we feel we have more experience now. But the key for us, since we don't really employ, we have one person that kind of works with forestry, but the key for our agency is to work closely with the Department of Forestry on these issues. And I defer, frankly, to them, perhaps, if they had some suggestions for our agency to be be able to move this through quickly. I'd have to defer to them. That's okay.
Well, we'll have an opportunity to hear from Ted Lawrenson from the Department of Forestry about this circumstance. What I'm going to suggest is that perhaps a group of us sit down together and we sort of talk this through.
Yes.
As a group of state natural resource agencies about how we can at least streamline the part of this in terms of state processes, and that's really what we're trying to do with this legislation is to force that issue so that there is a policy, not only a policy in place, but there's procedures in place so that when succeeding generations are faced with this, that clearly everyone will have those opportunities to move forward quickly.
Mr. Chair,
in your mind, if I may interrupt, where are we today with have you gotten any recent assessments of the value of that timber that's on the ground there?
Chair Krupp, it has deteriorated. There's no doubt about that. And the values that we started out with are certainly less than that. I've heard estimates that we've lost as much as 30 to 40% of the value that was there when the fire was completely put out.
Okay. And this is what type of wood primarily?
It's a pine and fir.
Pine and fir. Any additional questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Byer.
Thank you. And I'm not sure whether this is repeating information. I'm trying to sort this through my head. If we had had a policy like this prior to this incident, could you see any shortcuts in what had happened or how it was handled?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, if there had been some policies in place more directly instructing the agencies to move ahead quickly, we might have saved some time. In the end, most of the time will be because we have a lot of federal restrictions, we have listed fish species and those kinds of things. But I think some instruction to our agency might have cut some time, might have saved some time in this.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Foy and Craig. Been in operations that have purchased numerous salvage sales. Since Tillamook, we've been doing this, so I don't justify this delay. And this isn't our first fire. So I'm just curious: had we just sold the salvage sale, to a private enterprise and let them handle it, would that have expedited the matter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, probably not, because it probably was illegal for us to just turn it over to a private contractor without working with particularly the Fish and Wildlife Service, since the land was purchased with federal funds, and so there are restrictions on how we use and manage the state land.
Yeah, it is one of the signs of the times, I would suppose, members, that obviously, in previous burns over the years, and Representative Nelson, you referenced Tillamook. We didn't have an Endangered Species Act. We didn't have a great many issues that we have to comply with, including state policies on landslides and things of that nature that really are relevant, have been developed because of issues that have occurred. And so it has gotten very complex, and I think what we're trying to achieve, again, is for us to just develop the policies that make it smoother and easier for
us
to move forward on our end, knowing that there will be certain delays in dealing with the federal government and meeting the requirements that are necessary here.
Mr. Chair, to sum up, I'd be pleased to serve on a work group to work on this bill, the other agencies and yourself, and see if we can't put together something that would be helpful.
Okay, very good. And one last thing is there was part of this, the area that was burned, that was also belonged to the Oregon Parks Department.
Yes, sir.
And why were they able to come in and log almost immediately or in a very, very short period of time, and you were not able to?
Mr. Chair, I think there's been some misinformation somewhat on this parks thing, and it's kicked around a bit. What parks did was they came in immediately and only cut the trees they thought were needed for safety reasons. They did not come in immediately salvage the property. And if someone's from Parks here, he might correct me, but this is from all our discussions with Parks. That question did come up, frankly, on the tour in August. And then if you remember, after the tour when we met, there was questions about, well, why did we see these big trees left standing in the burned area of Parks? Why didn't they come salvage all of them? And what we found out later was Parks immediately went up there and salvaged the trees they thought were a safety hazard to people near the roadway. And so they did not really, quote, salvage the burned timber. And I hope that if I've misstated that, I hope someone from Parks corrects that. But from all our discussions with Parks, and they do have a person assigned to forestry issues for Parks, that's our understanding.
Now, the Parks property, however, was not purchased with the same federal dollars, correct?
That's correct, sir. And that's another issue,
that's
too.
That's an important distinction here for us to remember.
Yes.
So really, it was much simpler for them to go in and even accomplish the safety aspects, which you couldn't even do under the federal restrictions that you are under because of the circumstances.
Mr. Correct? Chair, that is correct.
That's correct.
So you can't do anything of that nature until you've satisfied the federal requirements that are already in place.
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good. Yes, Representative Smith.
Very quickly, thank you, Chair. Is there an end time to the when it is salvageable? You said we lost 30 to 40% since it burned. Is there an end game here for we have 3 years time limit?
No, it's
forestry. Chair Krupp, I would, and Representative Smith, I would ask forestry to comment on that. As the chairman said, we're not foresters, and we are mostly biologists.
You will. A good question, though.
That's a very good question.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. Is there no emergency clause in any of these laws, I mean, that provide us, or, you know, from having a catastrophic loss of the school fund or state money or employee or taxpayers' money, whether it's federal or state? Are there no emergency clauses? I mean, it makes me crazy to wait till the medflies devoured an area to go in and...
Representative Krupp and Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I believe with the circumstances here, first of all, Representative, I guess I'd have to check and see there's no emergency clauses in view of the circumstances of this fire that would have allowed it, that would have taken place. So I guess my answer is I'm not aware of any. And if there was any, certainly the federal government did not inform us of any. But to our knowledge, there isn't any in view of the circumstances of the fire.
I would concur. I'm certainly not aware of any, and we can ask forestry when they come up. All right, seeing no further questions, gentlemen, thank you very much. Craig, good to see you again. Hate to drag you all the way over here from the east side, but, hey, you needed to come over here. It's green anyway, right?
Well, I was here for the commission meeting, so Roy hooked me up.
Good time.
Thank you.
Chair would like to call, since we're talking about forestry, Ted, why don't you come on up? And then next on deck will be Steve Purchase from DSL in a moment, Steve. And Ted, who do you have with you today?
Chair Krupp and members of the committee, my name is Ted Lawrenson. I'm Assistant State Forester of the Oregon Department of Forestry. I have with me today Dan Mink, who's a real forester that works on the ground on these sorts of sales and probably can answer a lot of the technical questions better than I can. In terms of our written testimony, I guess we want to, in the policy context, really say that certainly the Board of Forestry and the Department of Forestry both support the notion of the need to actively manage forests and ecosystems to maintain healthy forest conditions. And in that context, both active fuels and vegetation management are important along with aggressive fire management, and that's a thing that's got to work together. This is for your information. I've attached a set of information that we passed out to many private landowners after the 2002 fire season to help them address their restoration needs. Gives you some sense of what requirements private lands would have to meet, and generally under the current conditions of the Forest Practices Act, how what sort of things they have to do to expedite their restoration activities. This bill particularly is addressed at state-owned lands. In terms of the fundamental principle or policy, we don't see anything inconsistent with what's being proposed. We would be concerned about DAS adopting policies that might make things worse, because I guess I'd say we have policies and procedures to expedite these sorts of processes. And would be concerned about potential conflicts there. But in terms of principles, we certainly would agree with the fundamental management direction. There are at least two critical forest health reasons to address salvage issues. And the first clearly is the issue in terms of insect outbreaks that may occur from damaged trees. And again, that can occur in a number of ecosystems. Certainly you are well aware and are concerned about the economic values that need to be addressed. And then the third reason in some ecotypes is the reburn risk. And the Tillamook burn is a good example that where actually the lack of salvage resulted in a number of reburns. And that's probably a more common issue in the Cascades and the Coast Range than would be in Eastern Oregon. But that's a third concern that really addresses the salvage problem. We have a number of examples here of what we've done on state forests in terms of post-fire salvage, and they're illustrative since two of the three were straightforward issues. You can get some sense of how fast we were able to proceed, and Dan put this together, and I would argue for the Asta fire, it would appear that they were probably out there putting up the timber sale about as fast as the mop-up was being completed, and probably the Indian Springs fire as well. The Quartz Creek fire, though, which occurred also in 2001, which like the Bridge Creek fire, is a little bit of a different story, and I think this really gets to maybe the root issue that you've been discussing in terms of the federal nexus. As noted, this fire wasn't a hot fire, and certainly many of the trees have live crowns, but they'll also die as a result of the heat, and they don't yet show signs of mortality. But we have two northern spotted owl sites on the sale, and we also need road use access, which then creates both an ESA and NEPA process issues. And you can see the huge difference in time between sales with or without federal nexus. So that kind of gets to the timing issue. You can certainly begin on a sale very, very quickly, but if you do have federal issues, that does create then time frames that are much different. Again, we do believe this bill is a part of the management activity we currently implement. I think probably the biggest barrier is the root problems in terms of the federal policies, and don't really have any solutions to offer you there other than maybe to suggest, and we certainly do this as we look at federal grant programs to make sure that they're entered into with an understanding that those risks are eliminated. For example, under the National Fire Program, when we accept dollars to do projects on the ground on private lands, if they're passed through to us where we actually make the grant decision, then there isn't a federal nexus in terms of the ESA or NEPA. But if the federal agencies actually are part of the decision-making process, then there is, and then those processes are applied. So there are some things you can do in terms of accepting federal dollars. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, one question for you in regards to if we put a policy like this in place, would it create issues, problems for you in entering into agreements with the federal government?
Chair Krupp, I don't see this policy as contradicting compliance with federal or state laws, so it probably wouldn't. On the other hand, it doesn't solve that fundamental problem either.
Okay. Members, questions? Absolutely.
Is there an end time to the when it becomes unsalvageable?
Chair Krupp,
for the record, state your name.
Dan Mink.
Yeah, thank you.
Department of Forestry. Chair Krupp, Representative Smith. There's a number of factors that will impact that. There's no real concrete, this happens every time answer. The size of the timber, the species of the timber, how hot the burn was, whether, you know, the type of weather events that also happen after that. Is also an influence as to how long. So it's on a case-by-case basis. I'm not really familiar with this Bridge Creek instance, so I couldn't say, you know, as of January 1st, 2004, it's, you know, not any value.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. I guess my concern is, on an average, if we have a wildfire that burns, and I'm looking at timelines in these bills that we're trying to do and all the processes that we go through, is there a time when it becomes unmarketable?
Yeah, I would generally say that within 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
That's what I was looking for. Thank you.
Members, when we took the trip over to view the Bridge Creek fire, it was interesting in that we saw examples of some of the logs that had been cut off of the private timberlands. And what was occurring is there's a, and you can expand on this, but I found this fascinating because I'd never seen this before. There is a blue fungus that begins to eat its way through the logs, and it destroys the value of it. And it accelerates in the summertime. Could you explain that process?
Chair Krupp, what I believe you're referring to is the blue stain. And it's a fungus that basically gets into the wood, I believe through pine beetles is what introduces it. And they're really active in the springtime. So that's how it gets introduced into the wood, you know, and that's why in the summertime then it really progresses throughout the wood as the larvae from the beetles are, you know, growing and stuff.
Does the acceleration... Or is the loss of the timber, the degradation of the timber, accelerate once you get into that second year in terms of the speed of degradation?
Chair Croft, yes. As the timeline goes, it accelerates exponentially, I guess you could say, you know, because you have rot and staining going on.
Okay. Representative Nelson, and then Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm concerned about where the biggest delays occurred. I mean, there had to be delays caused somewhere by somebody. And, you know, as I look for who's liable for the loss of, you know, the taxpayers' money, the schools' money, this, you know, regardless of whose it is, where were those big delays, and why did they have it?
Okay. Chair Krupp and Representative Nelson, members of the committee, there's really kind of what I'd call two impacts of process. And in the federal process really requires, once you get into the nexus of the federal issues, you've got evaluation phases where basically there's got to be determinations of potential effects, and based upon that determination, then you may have to do a range of analysis. And so you have, you know, basically processes to make determinations, and you got process to make analyses. And as the Department of Fish and Wildlife staff pointed out, when they had to do the archaeological survey, that drove up then costs that they might not have otherwise had to incur. And process can become such a burden that it makes a sale then uneconomic as time goes on, and that's a real risk. The other impact that you see in terms of the process, and I don't know the specifics in terms of the condition on the Bridge Creek sale, but in many cases, as the federal agencies are trying to permit these processes, they will condition them based upon certain standards. And, for example, like road use permits, they'll use that as a segue into private land management, where they might require a private land manager to do something on their own lands to get a road use permit. Now, some of that's been resolved, and some of it's still a problem. But they then may require, as a condition of getting that road use permit, you might have to leave a 300-foot buffer instead of a 100-foot buffer. And that, in eastern Oregon, can have a huge impact. And so that's kind of in dealing with those incremental changes in terms of how the sale is anticipated to be laid out, can have a huge delaying impact. I would imagine the consulting forester, as he develop an RFP, had one vision of what the sale might look like, and then as the conditions were put on it, what becomes economic and what the conditions might be would have to be totally adjusted, and you're going to have to redo the sale, and the economics change radically. So that's those have huge impacts on time.
Mr. Chair, thank you for those answers. Did we write these up, and have we, you know, alerted our congressional delegation that 90% of the cause of the loss of our funding was by their federal activities, or non-activity, I guess we should say?
Chair Krupp, President Nelson, members of the committee, in terms of the actual dollar amount, I wouldn't, you know, claim how much that impacted that, but I'd certainly say we have alerted the Oregon legislative body of these issues, and I remember last session we had quite a discussion about federal road use permits and that sort of thing that didn't resolve anything. We have certainly worked with our congressional delegation as well to address some of these issues. It is fair to say the federal agencies have improved the timing of some of their processes. Just 5 years ago, probably at a minimum, it would take 2 years to address a simple road use permit that a private landowner may need, and it may not be that long on average anymore in a substantially different way. So they have improved their timing, but those barriers basically are still there. They may not be quite as lengthy, though.
And just to let you know, Representative Nelson and members, that I am preparing, at leadership's direction, a resolution to Congress to advise them, especially in regards to the Biscuit Fire down south, which burnt just slightly less than 500,000 acres, some of which is wilderness and would never be considered for any type of salvage logging proposal, but there's still a lot of timber down there, and the resolution to Congress will simply basically just say we want you to move forward in an expeditious manner to try and salvage what's appropriate there, so that we don't end up losing that precious resource totally, and that some is retained obviously. And that actually leads me to a question I wanted to ask you about. You gave a Quartz Creek fire here, talking about the issues. It wasn't a hot fire. It burnt through quickly. Crowns are still alive. But there will be some death due to girding from the heat at the base. How will you and when will you begin the determination of removing, perhaps very selectively, those trees that appear to be dying?
Chair Krupp, that process will be... As I understand, they're going to do what we call an auto mark, which the purchaser is the person that chooses which tree to take. But there are guidelines on that, and the guidelines of that sale will be a percentage of base burned and, you know, a certain amount of charring or, you know, some... impact that they can visually see on the ground, and that's what they'll use.
So in terms of a quote-unquote salvage, a normal salvage logging operation, if there is such a thing, this is very different. This is where you're really, because it wasn't a hot fire, it was a pretty fast-moving fire, you want to save as many trees as you can that look like they're going to make it. So you're going to be very selective in this process. Now, that's different than what we're talking about with hot fires, where it's really intentional. You bake the soil beyond its ability to support vegetative life, which is some of what we saw at Bridge Creek. In that regard, even when you do that type of more comprehensive salvage logging, I would assume you're still wanting, and this is where you have to work with ODF&W in terms of the biology, you still want to leave some trees there for... purposes of having some rotting timber and birds to nest in and so forth. How do you make that determination?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, we, under our management plans that we have, we are to leave, you know, a certain number of standing trees, of standing green trees, and a certain number of standing snags. So we base those decisions on the plan as far as how many. There are a number of management plans on the for the different areas of the Department of Forestry. So I don't want to say certain numbers because each plan may have a different number. But that's what we use to determine what's left. We also have requirements of downwood, you know, so many cubic feet of downwood will be left in areas as well. There's riparian areas that would require, you know, extra protection as well.
Chair Krupp, if I may, it's the detail in the back here kind of gets to some of the requirements on the Forest Practice Act would be applied on private lands. Those also are the base for state lands as well. One of the interesting approaches that the Forest Practice Act used, which gets to one of the questions that was asked earlier in terms of is there flexibility in terms of addressing catastrophic things, the Forest Practice Act itself has a special exemption in terms of like riparian protection. If you have a catastrophic fire, then it basically says, look, you have an excess of dead material, you can remove more of it, but then you have some obligations in terms of getting reforestation quickly and that kind of stuff. So that has inherent flexibility built in it to address catastrophic events, and that's a really good approach. And that I am not aware of that being the case in any of the federal law at this point in time.
Now, you bring up in your submitted testimony that generally the intent of this legislation, getting back to it, is really looks like it's compatible. You, and if I may paraphrase, you seem to be saying that your concern would be that DAS would promulgate rules that would be inconsistent with other policies that you already have in place. In the rulemaking process, if they would work very closely with you and ODF&W and other state agencies, do you think we could adequately address that before we brought those rules to public hearing?
Chair Krupp, I'm sure we could. I guess it raises the fundamental question, do we need more process or not? And as long as this doesn't add process, we can certainly live with any standards they might otherwise promote that would be consistent with this.
Well, you know, we legislators love process. And, one last question from my viewpoint. If we were to, would it be a burden on your in your way of thinking as I hate to use the word, but bureaucrats for less than another term. If we were to put in, if part of the rules were to say that DAS would develop policies that would immediately begin the process of, if there were certain timelines that you would have to adhere to in terms of receiving an RFP for the cultural aspects, receiving an RFP for, if those timelines were in reasonable length of time, but were it cast in the rules, would that create problems for you as an agency, given that we don't have lots of money to give you for personnel these days?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, basically the management of state forest lands is a self-funded program, and there are procedures in place to implement timber sales that have already gone through some level of coordination with DAS in terms of the contracting and stuff like that. So long as we coordinate stuff, I wouldn't see it necessarily as a burden, though I would say this. We're pretty lean and mean, and any more rule processes that we have to work on is just one more thing to work on that's going to mean we're not going to be out there putting up timber sales. So, you know, you're going to have to make a decision here on whether that process is going to add something to the policy you want to adopt or not, and I can't answer that. But my general impression would be that we can probably sit down as a group and come up with a fundamental set of procedures and checkoffs, and that'll work for everybody. The one area of caution I would have, though, and this has become more of a problem the last several years, during the 2003 fire season, we had 75% of our employees out fighting fires, and some of them were out there for 6 or 8 weeks, basically working 12 to 16, 18 hours a day. The other 25% that weren't fighting fire were trying to hold the fort down, and you can see we were able to get things going pretty quickly on these sales, but quite frankly, our state forest managers are also our firefighters in these sorts of events, and assuming that you had a fire like in July of this year, and we were still fighting fire in August, a deadline could be impossible to meet. And we have seen more and more of our work just stop in July, August, and us not being able to get back to doing other things until September and October. I mean, things have really gotten that interesting with the fires. So that would be the one caution.
Okay. So noted.
Okay.
And good point. Gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate your input today. Steve, Division of State Lands. Up on deck will be Dave Barrels after Division. And after that, we have the Audubon Society of Portland. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Steve Perks, Assistant Director of Field Operations for Division of State Lands, joined by Jeanette Holman, Assistant Director for Fiscal Administration. I want to thank my coworkers for going through and going first, because I think they answered a lot of the committee's questions. But let me just kind of divert a little bit from my written testimony that you have in front of you to let you know that we have statutory language in 273.522, which gives us the authority to do just exactly what your policy is directing us to do, or what the agency or DAS may direct us to do. I think one of our concerns is, and I've heard it from both the other agencies, is that depending on what the policy is and how that might conflict with our statutory direction that we have, as well as our trust responsibilities on the Common School Fund, and how that may also be addressed in our asset management plan the agency developed a number of years ago, which is approved by our state land board. So our only concern would be that while we understand the direction the committee wants to go in, and we agree in principle with the policy and more than willing to serve on a committee, we would express some concerns about how that policy might be in conflict with our trust responsibilities. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So then you would think that to address those concerns, we would have to carefully craft the policy to not be conflicting with your responsibilities in regards
to... Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And we'd be happy to work with either Department of Administrative Services or yourself to try to do that.
So the current statute here in your prepared testimony says that you already have the authority to sell. And I think the minutiae that we would say is the reasoning for this bill is that even though we recognize you have the authority, we would like you to expedite that process, even though you do currently have the authority. Any other potential problems that you see in this legislation other than what you've notated so far?
Mr. Chairman, no, there isn't.
Okay. Very good. And I would assume that you, of course, would want to be involved in that the effort of sitting down with DAS and promulgating the rules.
Mr. Chairman, we look forward to that.
Very good. Members, questions? Thank you both. Appreciate it. Hey, Barrels.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Barrows, and I'm appearing before this committee on numerous occasions this session wearing a variety of hats. Today I'm here representing the Association of Oregon and California Revested Railroad Grant Lands. These are lands all in Oregon.
That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. I've been with them 37 years, and about 2 years ago I could get it out without stumbling. These are lands, Mr. Chairman, that are in all the western counties of Oregon, with the exception of Clatsop, and in one eastern Oregon county, Klamath, that are managed primarily by the Bureau of Land Management, about 1 million acres of BLM managed lands, and about 250,000 of acres managed by the U.S. Forest Service. So this bill doesn't apply directly to any of the lands that are in the association I represent. But the whole issue of burned and diseased and otherwise impaired timber is of grave concern to our association. And we wish there was some way to expand this to have it apply to the U.S. Forest Service lands and the BLM lands in western Oregon, which are the premier... The ONC lands are the premier timberlands managed by the federal forest agencies in the nation, no question about it. Our hope is that the passage of this type of legislation, and this all, Mr. Chairman, is just I mean, it doesn't put rules into the statute. It just tells DAS to make rules. And with all due respect to my good friend, Mr. Elliker, it does not say all timber, all burned timber. It just said burned timber. So our hope is that the passage of this, hopefully, would be noted by the federal agencies, and that as they go through their processes of trying to figure out ways to expedite the utilization of this very valuable resource, which gosh knows we have plenty of in southwestern Oregon this year. I mean, the Biscuit Fire alone. And while the numbers for volume loss are not quite as dramatic in Douglas fir as they are in some of these other species, they are still dramatic. And it's just a wasted resource that we passionately feel is better served by for all the people and to the counties and their revenues by moving quickly to attack these problems. So we urge your support of this bill, which we hope is, will have more meaning with the federal agencies than a memorial. Thank you.
Good point, Dave. I would think that you would be concerned about the issues you've talked about in terms of management, not only just the overall federal management techniques versus techniques that our own Department of Forestry has employed very successfully in terms of fire load issues and thinning. You would be concerned that salvage logging, for the two reasons that Department of Forestry talked about in terms of the loss of the value, but also the potential infestation that may occur on unburnt lands that are directly related to ONC. So doesn't it, in your mind, underscore the importance of changing the federal policy and at the same time us on the state level moving forward more expeditiously to keep those infestations from spreading into healthy forests? Because we have a burnt forest, and then you begin to see the tremendous issues, disease issues. To me, it seems that that also creates issues for you, because you would look at the potential lost revenue down the road from that would be enormous, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct, and especially in the case of the ONC lands, because almost all of these lands are checkerboarded, either with other with private lands or small woodlot lands or state lands or U.S. Forest Service lands. I mean, our neighbors in these checkerboard patch lands are a wide group of folks, and they should all be concerned about the spread of disease and infestations of all of a wide nature. And we've dealt with those agencies for many years on that very topic that you've so eloquently stated, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Chair would like to call, is it Abilene Taylor?
Yes.
Thank you. Welcome, and come forward. Is there anyone else with you? Oh, I see you've got Mr. Kafori. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here representing the Portland chapter of the Audubon Society today. Wanted to start off just to say that we appreciate the chair's suggestion about getting agencies together. We think the bill is has a goal that perhaps is not worded as carefully and as accurately as we'd like it to be. We have some also like to present a different perspective on the issue of forest fires. And I have with me Evelyn Taylor, who's Assistant Conservation Director at the Portland Audubon Society.
Very good. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Evelyn Taylor, and I'm the Assistant Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. I'm actually testifying today on behalf of Sybil Ackerman, who's our Conservation Director. She unfortunately was unable to attend today's hearing. The Audubon Society of Portland recognizes that trees killed by wildfires have an economic value that can decline rapidly as decay sets in. However, we also recognize that burned forests provide important habitat values and that these forests may be particularly vulnerable to damage from inappropriate salvage logging. Thoughtful, science-based planning can help ensure compatibility between post-fire salvage logging and the maintenance of habitat and other ecological values. The extreme breadth and urgency of House Bill 2344, however, may require state agencies to act with haste and little thought about a comprehensive strategy for post-fire salvage logging. This could cause an increase in long-term environmental problems. For example, salvage logging on steep and unstable slopes, erosive or fragile soil types, or affecting streams, riparian areas, and or mature and old growth trees could create environmental problems that may be costly in the long run. The Audubon Society of Portland asks that state agencies move forward with thoughtful, science-based processes rather than the simplistic urgency expressed in House Bill 2344. Post-fire salvage logging is based on the flawed premise that a burned forest, like a wrecked car or a sunken ship, has lost all functional value, and the only thing to be done is to capture whatever economic value remains. Nothing could be further from the truth. Burned forests, while changed, are still functioning forests that provide important habitat for many species, most notably a variety of woodpeckers that thrive on beetle larvae and abundant nesting opportunities. Watersheds and soils are typically still quite functionable, but are more vulnerable to damage from poorly planned logging. The best way to move forward with post-fire salvage logging is to be conservative, for example, to leave abundant large dead trees to benefit woodpeckers and other wildlife in the short term and soil productivity in the long term. Additional provisions to buffer streams and to protect steep slopes and fragile soils through the use of helicopters and avoiding new road building is also something that should be thought through carefully prior to post-fire salvage logging. House Bill 2344 does not include any safeguards of this sort, but rather promotes a single-minded pursuit of the short-term economic value of logging. For these reasons, the Audubon Society of Portland respectfully asks that the committee vote against House Bill 2344. We also will refer any questions to Sybil Ackerman, the Conservation Director, and Stephen can get back to you with the answer. I unfortunately am not an expert on this issue, and so we'd like to have Sybil get back to you with an answer.
Very good, Evelyn. Testimony, and I always enjoy it when people admonish me to be. Stephen, anything else to add?
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Members,
thank
questions? Representative Hunt.
I mean, and maybe it's something that you can get back on.
We will.
One of the previous witnesses referenced the fact that the actual bill references efforts to harvest burned timber. Doesn't say harvest all burned timber. I guess my question is, are you concerned that DAS would not be judicious in administering that, and that's why you think safeguards need to be built in, or are you interpreting this to mean harvest all burned timber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, I think what we're concerned about is the general tone of the bill and not the specific words, and I think that that's not going to be a problem if I understand the chair's intention. So we're not concerned at that point. And in terms of the state agencies, we think there's certainly ample sensitivity in Oregon state agencies on scientific matters and environmental matters, in our experience.
Very good.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Chair, I'd like to call Jared Broadfoot forward, if you would, please. Jared, do you have anyone else with you here today? Just you? All right. Welcome to the Lion's Den.
I feel right at home. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot. Here personally to give some insight into specifically the Bridge Creek fire and some work that I did on that. My family owns Broadfoot Logging out of Hermiston, Oregon. And specifically on the Bridge Creek fire, when that fire started to burn, I was on the fire and actually helped to supervise our crew our logging crew to help put the fire out. We were on private land that we knew the landowners, Pioneer Resources, owned ground just across the freeway from the Department of Fish and Wildlife's ground. After the fire was extinguished, quite a bit of time went by, and questions started coming out of that local community, specifically Ukiah, as to why the department had not moved to start salvaging the timber, that the residents quickly realized that there was a lot of value in that timber that could be then put back into wildlife management purposes. That prompted, of course, phone calls, and the chair actually said, "What can we do about this? I'm very interested." And the chairman worked very hard to get a meeting together, set up a meeting between Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Forestry, some private timber owners, the community, and bring everybody together over there to see exactly what was going on. You've heard the results of that meeting, and I would like to commend the Department of Fish and Wildlife and Department of Forestry for the tremendous effort that they put into this, specifically the Bridge Creek fire. There was federal involvement, and that oftentimes slows processes down, and that's what slowed this process down. I do want to note several things, that our company did go in and conduct salvage logging on some of the private ground, and the reference to steep ground, to unstable soil, it's absolutely correct. We logged on some incredibly steep ground that probably shouldn't be attempted with the type of equipment we did, but we have very skilled and professional people who run our equipment, and to tell you the truth, when looking both up close and from a distance, as the chair can speak to, there was very little ground disturbance. Our technology allows us to go into a ground that has been severely damaged by an intense hot fire and do a salvage operation without disturbing and actually helping the ground. There are, of course, according to the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which has been referenced many times today, in my opinion, it's a great act, and it has laid the groundwork, at least on the private ground that we've done, for reforestation and the overall improvement of the quality of those stands of timber. So in all, I think this is a good bill, and what it will do is, you know, give some direction so when we have a piece of ground that does burn, that we can get in there and assess it, not only for wildlife management purposes, for every other purpose, and not to go in and log it all and take all of the burnt timber. That's that common sense for us anyway tells us that's not the best thing to do. So there are a lot of things that go into, you know, doing a bid and looking at those pieces of timber. So I would be happy to answer any questions, and I hope I've provided some insight into what actually happened on that fire, and what can be done on pieces that are very steep, even if they're not steep, but the type of work that can be done and improve the health of the stands that have been burnt, and leave some behind too as well for wildlife habitat.
Very good. Members, questions? Hearing none. Thank you, Jared.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to continue to hear this bill at a later date. So we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2344, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2396. Ray, you want to tell us a little bit about what this bill is about?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this bill is brought to the committee sponsored by Representative Close. It provides a pesticide use report shall identify the location of use by zip code. It provides for the publication of summary of use on the basis of areas comprised of one or more zip codes, and it applies to data reported to pesticide use that occurs on or after January 1st, 2004. It requires the State Department of Agriculture allow filing of pesticide reports in paper form. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ray. Chair would like to call Representative Betsy Close. Welcome, Madam Chair. Good to see you.
Thank you very much, Representative Krepp. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this bill. And thank you, members of the Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee. I'm State Representative Betsy Close, and I have sponsored this bill on behalf of a pest extermination company in my district who requested this. It's a family-owned and operated business, one of our Oregon small businesses that provide jobs in our local communities. The pesticide use reporting system, called PERS, I assume that's another PERS, was established by House Bill 3602 during the 1999 session. It directed the Department of Agriculture to administer the program and construct a database. The information gained was to be confidential. The department received $180,000 to administer the new program. Currently, the Department of Agriculture has announced an extension of the deadline for reporting 2002 pesticide use due to lack of funds. This bill, House Bill 2396, is an attempt to deal with the confidentiality aspects of the original bill. Harassment by anti-pesticide groups of farms and businesses is a concern to them. Because reporting is to be done currently by section, township, and range instead of by zip code or one of 19 watersheds, businesses are concerned that their costs will be high. One business in the pilot program, I am told, called this a disaster to track, requiring 97 man-hours per month, causing the need for a half-time person be hired. And they were doing section, township, range reporting. This is apparently due to the fact that there's no software for computers to use on this kind of reporting. There are computer advantages to reporting by zip code, and the state of California has reported by county for 15 years. So there's a number of different options that we could use, in other words. And I'm open to other options of reporting that this committee may want to consider. My main concern is that the Agriculture and Business Committee have their concerns addressed through legislation if necessary, so that this government reporting mandate is not a huge burden on them. And thank you for your interest in the pesticide use reporting issue.
Thank you, Representative. Members, questions for Representative Close? Come on, we're not going to let her off that easy, are we? Gee.
All right, I'll ask her one.
All right, go ahead. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Close, in terms of the funding for this, the PERS system, will ODA be capable of publishing the first annual report summarizing the pesticide use data by watershed basis or the section, township, range by July 1st, 2003 as directed by the law?
Representative Krepp, Representative Worth, I am, of course, not an expert on this issue. All I have is what we took off the Internet saying that the deadline has been extended to April 30th, 2003 for all those required to report their 2002 pesticide use. This was as of December 4th. And apparently they have a temporary system that will be generating a statewide report by its July 1st, 2003 deadline.
I'll call it, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So currently, then, the extension, as I understand it, is due to the lack of funding coming from this body. Do you understand it differently?
Representative Krupp, Representative Worth, that is my understanding.
Thank you.
Okay. Members, anything additional? Representative Hunt and Representative Smith.
Representative Close, thanks for coming today. Not having been here last session, I may just have a question or two, trying to catch myself up mentally. Just looking at the bill that was passed previously, and the section that would be amended out through this change, it references the pesticide stakeholder group that had been appointed previously, which, as I understand, has been working on these efforts to try and identify the areas in which the reporting data should be gathered. My understanding of that group, but so I guess correct me if I'm wrong, is that they came back with a much smaller scale of reporting, that this was an industry and environmental group combined. They came back with a smaller reporting area, and that they actually didn't favor the larger zip code reporting. I guess my question is, if that stakeholder group, which was called for under the previous bill, came back with a smaller recommendation, why would we be looking at a larger recommendation now?
Representative Krupp, Representative Hunt, as you may or may not know, when groups are appointed to report on any issue, that means that other people are excluded. And so my constituent did not feel they had access to that group. I realize that group came up with certain recommendations. However, This is the public body, really, where the public comment is brought forward. And so even though I realize that that did happen, I think that I owe it to my constituent to be able to present their concerns here, because they were not able to do so. We're not able to do so to their degree of comfort.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I've heard a lot in the interim about the filing by computer systems. And I see in here you're addressing the option of being able to file by paper. Did you also hear that concern?
Representative Krupp, Representative Smith, what I was told by my constituent is that in the pilot program, they were trying to do it by computer because of time, you know, the time element. But that was still requiring this huge input of man hours to that particular group doing it in the pilot program. So, you know, I think they would be open to that, but their concern is that they don't have to hire new people just for this mandate. And how you do that, you know, I'm open to whatever the committee decides. You'll have a lot of testimony on this issue, but my concern is that it at least be discussed.
Thank you. Chair, what I heard from my constituents, for people who don't have computers, they had to go clerk or an extension office or someone to do the
Yeah, one of the debates that we had on this issue in 1999 was the cost to the Department of Agriculture to comply with a paper reporting system in terms of personnel and wading through all of that. And that's one of the reasons that technology was the mandate in the legislation. And it does create a perplexing problem, because there are some folks, and I will announce at this point in time that of a potential conflict of interest on this legislation, because I am, as a farmer, required to report under the current system and any further system that may be developed. But there are farmers much older than I am that recall the first time man flew, and they're really, that's a long time ago, and they're really not interested in doing this at all, and a few of my contemporaries my age are not interested either. They especially are not interested in technology because they don't own computers. I mean, it's pretty simple. And so that brings the issue that you brought forward. And that's one of the reasons that I appreciate, Representative, you've placed into your bill the option of. And I think that's a fair assessment. For some folks, there should be an option. It'd be a number of years, I think, before every household in Oregon is online with a computer, and I think it's a reasonable idea that we should discuss. So
thank you very much.
Good to see you. Representative Beyer, I'm sorry, and Representative Worth also. Okay, my apologies.
Representative Post, not really having heard a lot of concerns from people. I am hopefully looking forward to testimony on what their concerns are and the problems. My concern is that we really have no history of this or how it is working or could work, because it really hasn't happened yet. And so I'm wondering why we need to change it until we know for sure whether it works.
Representative Krupp, Representative Beyer, we do have the experience of California that I mentioned, where they've been doing it for 15 years. And the concern on the part of business, I will tell you, is that in California they feel like that data has been collected through a lot of trouble by the businesses involved, but it's never really been used in any way. It just kind of sits there. And so I think, you know, it's a good idea when we bring it into Oregon, we ask our businesses to do this, that because we do want to know what's going into the environment, but we need to make it so it's affordable for them, so they don't have to hire new people or lay off people. So this is a business issue, not so much an issue about, you know, giving it a chance. It's already here, but let's make it reasonable.
Quick follow-up.
Sure.
If you broaden the boundaries too much, does that in effect kind of dilute the results or the ability to use the information?
Representative Krupp, Representative Beyer, are you talking about the confidentiality issue?
Well, yeah, more of knowing, you know, where certain pesticides are actually being used. If you have too broad an area, how are you going to be able to narrow in on where it's happening?
Well, my understanding is that the Department of Agriculture would have that information, and it would be their responsibility to take care of any problems that arose. However, the concern on the part of business is that outside groups that would be able to narrowly target them for harassment, that is their concern. That's why they want the confidentiality. But the agency, they would have the information they need. That's my understanding, but I am not the expert on this.
Thank you. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Post, by identifying the location of use by zip code and publication of summary use on the basis of areas comprised of one or more zip codes, how much larger of a geographical area could this potentially represent as opposed to the maximum area on the basis of section, township, range, or identified watershed that we now provide for?
Representative Krupp, Representative Worth, I guess you'd have to look at the number of zip codes that we have in Oregon. I don't know the number right off the hand. I know with watersheds there's 19, so that if you did go to watersheds, which is not in this bill, but you could, there would be 19 watersheds across the state. So that would broaden it a lot more. But their interest beyond broadening it is also the software that's available for reporting. And that's why I used zip codes, because apparently there is software for the zip code. So it was more a concern of the computer technology than the size of the area, although that is also a concern.
Okay, I'll follow up, Mr.
Yes.
And so when you say publication of use on the basis of areas comprised of one or more zip codes, is there a maximum allowable number of zip codes in the area that you're identifying there?
Representative Krupp, Representative Worth, I couldn't answer that. You would need an expert witness, I think, from Department of Ag.
And final follow-up?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm sensitive to the lack of computer technology for all of this data. I think our schools have a similar problem with all the SIM and CAM reporting. So, but the PERS system, the idea is to have a data set that is, you know, the scientific research is able to manipulate and use and do studies with. So, if, and the law prescribes that we are to provide a system that is, you know, that in a manner that reduces paperwork and reporting costs. So by the end users, you know, turning in these mounds of paperwork, I mean, how then are we going to allow the scientific researchers to use that data in a manner prescribed by the idea of the law, except a lot of data entry?
Representative Krupp, Representative Worth, I would just say my opinion is that if businesses are required to submit that much paperwork, that ought to be a red flag to us that maybe we're asking too much and we need to streamline it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Great to see you. Appreciate you coming forward. All right, the chair would like to call Matt Blevins, Rhett Loritz, and Courtney Dresser. You all want to come up together, please.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, for the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. Founded in 1968, the Oregon Environmental Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization with more than 2,000 members throughout the state. We bring Oregonians together for a healthy environment. House Bill 2396 would make some significant changes to Oregon's pesticide use reporting program, which was passed by the 1999 legislature 88-2. OEC was one of the organizations that supported the legislation and has been closely involved in the implementation of the program. There are two key elements to this bill. One would require ODA to allow pesticide users the option of filing pesticide reports in paper form. The other would change the law so that the location of all pesticide use would be reported by zip code. OEC supports the first part of the bill and strongly opposes the second, and I'll explain that quickly. First, OEC supports policies that make it easier for pesticide users to report their information to ODA. We have been a strong proponent of full funding for the program, but the legislature has yet to fully fund the program. In fact, at this point, ODA has had to put the program development on hold due to a lack of funding. What this means is that while there is a system online to collect information, ODA reports that it is crashing on a regular basis, causing headaches and additional costs for both the agency and those who have to report. So while we support the idea of giving pesticide users the option of reporting on paper, we just don't see how this is possible until the legislature provides revenue for ODA to make this happen. ODA has estimated that the paper-based reporting would cost $695,000 to operate in the first biennium of the program. And that, again, is, as we've heard before, why it was left out in the first place. On the second element of the bill, OEC is strongly opposed. First, it makes no sense to make such a fundamental change to the system before it has even had a chance to work. Second, using zip code as a location identifier for all the pesticide use reports will make the information ODA collects meaningless or useless. A number of researchers and federal, state, and local health and environmental officials have made recommendations to ODA regarding how best to implement the program so that the data they collect can be put to good use. These agencies consistently requested site-specific information at the level of township, range, and section, or even smaller. In fact, some agencies made it clear that the reporting at a location larger than a square mile would be essentially useless to them. For example, the National Marine Fisheries Service recommended ideally GPS would be used, but suggested township, range, and section, or quarter section, should be the minimum required. The U.S. Geological Survey recommended that for the National Water Quality Assessment Program, township, range, and section, quote, would be the ideal level of detail for usefulness. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service stated, quote, designations such as county, watershed, or zip code are too general to be useful. Specific location information is needed, such as township, section, and range, or other precise coordinates. The U.S. EPA highlighted specific locations such as street address, township, range, section, tax or field location ID, or GPS coordinates as, quote, critical to assess drinking water exposure and also to link residue data to actual use data for risk assessments. Catherine Thompson and Michael Heumann, epidemiologists with the Oregon Health Division, say that township and range could make the data almost useless for surveillance, population response, and public health studies. Dennis Nelson, groundwater coordinator for the Oregon Health Division, said that pesticide use reporting at the township range level limits the utility and, quote, from the drinking water protection strategy perspective, township range is too large for district use. And finally, the Oregon Department of Forestry, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Oregon Department of Environmental Quality requested information at the township range and section level. The letters from several of these agencies are attached to my testimony for the record. For 18 months from January 2000 to June 2001, OEC and a number of other members here who were up at the table with me and others were active members of the Pesticide Use Reporting Work Group assigned to advise the Oregon Department of Agriculture on the implementation of Oregon's pesticide tracking program. There were 18 individuals on this work group, 9 from the pesticide user community and 9 from what we call the data user community. As a group, we spent countless hours discussing a range of issues related to the implementation of Oregon's pesticide use reporting program, and we agreed on the process for making decisions, and then made the following recommendations related to how pesticide users should report your location. Agriculture and forestry should report uses of pesticides by township, range, and section. 9 work group members, including all the pesticide user groups, voted for the township, range, and section, and 5 voted for an area 4 times smaller. Nobody voted for zip code. Commercial urban pesticide users should report by zip code, and this vote was 9-5 in favor of zip code, with 5 dissenting votes wanting exact address. Section, township, or range equals 1 square mile or 640 acres. Since zip codes are population-based, they range in size from several square miles in the urban areas up to hundreds of square miles in the rural parts of the state. Some have suggested that collecting information about pesticide use at the section, township, range level would potentially compromise the privacy of certain pesticide users. Privacy issues have been thoroughly addressed by ODA, and there's an attached letter from just last month that ODA wrote on the subject. The law requires ODA to keep confidential any information that reveals the identity of the owner or address of private property where pesticides have been applied. In fact, the law allows ODA to assess a fine of up to $10,000 for anyone who breaches this confidentiality requirement. This is a very severe fine. By comparison, Oregon law carries a $5,000 fine for a Class A misdemeanor, including misdemeanor assault, some drug offenses, and most pertinently, unlawful release of genetic information. This strong confidentiality provision was included in the law because the drafters knew the data would be collected and that could reveal the name and address of the pesticide applicator in certain situations. This is why there is a distinction between how the information is reported to the agency and how it is reported by the agency to the public. Therefore, there is absolutely no reason to compromise the effectiveness of the data due to the concerns over confidentiality. And I just want to quickly address two other points that Representative Close raised in terms of the California specificity. They actually do have to report by specific location application, not by county. So they have to actually report where exactly by address they have to report they've used pesticides in their program. Also, in terms of the burden on business, in fact, in California, they don't just sit on the data. They've actually been able to use that effectively to, in fact, businesses have used it effectively to reduce the amount of pesticides they use or to track how much they're using and reduce their costs. In fact, we have a letter that we can supply to you from the Lodi Woodbridge Wine Growing District, which is the largest wine growing district in California, that they've actually attested to the fact they found it actually very useful in their programs in reducing their costs as a business. So I think there's actually good examples out there for business and why we need this plan. So to conclude, OEC strongly encourages the committee to reject this bill in its current form. Thank you.
Take questions. Thank you, Matt. I've got a quick question for you. On the earlier part, the front page of your testimony down at the bottom, you talked about the paper reporting system and that ODA had made an estimate, and that seems to be what I recall. If we had it as an option in this legislation, given that we have the beginning of an internet-based system in place, is it your opinion that cost would probably be quite a bit lower than that because some folks are already reporting online and some of the folks that I mentioned earlier might be the only ones submitting paperwork?
My understanding is that this figure of $695,000 is what the ODA estimates it would be their cost in addition to having web-based. That they don't see a huge offset there. At least that's not the information they've given me. You'd have to check with them to confirm that. But that's my understanding is that this would not be in place of, but in addition to. So.
Okay. Thank you, Matt.
I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Close cited the lack of adequate computer technology as the reason to expand this to allow for paper reporting. So is it in your opinion if the legislature fully funded the PERS system as it is, you know, according to law, would the reporting, the lack of computer technology for reporting be a problem that it is now?
It shouldn't be. I mean, again, I think the understanding would be that a fully funded, adequately funded program would include the option for paper reporting for those folks who needed it.
So currently you characterize mostly Representative Close's concerns requiring the reporting in terms of the end user as mainly a lack of funding by the legislature.
That's our understanding.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
For the record.
My name is Rhett Lawrence. I am an environmental advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocacy organization with more than 25,000 members across the state of Oregon. So I'm here today to share OSPIRG's views on House Bill 2396. As Matt mentioned, OSPIRG did work in coalition with Oregon Environmental Council and other organizations, including the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, as part of the stakeholder group that worked through some of the details of the 1999 bill, and we also worked extensively on through the rulemaking process in 2001 to determine how the program was going to be implemented. And we believe that House Bill 2396 runs counter to many of the accomplishments that we achieved in the program through those processes, and so we're here to oppose it in its current form. And we do actually support the requirement that ODA allow for pesticide users to have the option of filing their reports on paper. In fact, we supported that option all along. And as Representative Smith mentioned, just as a matter of fairness, because you know not all farmers have access. Not all pesticide users have access to computers or the internet, so we do think that it is a good plan to have, and so we would be in favor of any measure which would allow pesticide users to make to be easier to report their data. But as has already been noted, such a policy will add costs to a program that's already on hold because of a lack of funding. And so it's unclear where the money would come from to implement that program unless those funds are raised from some other source. Our coalition is, in fact, working on a bill right now which would expand dealer fees for the pesticide use reporting system. So that's one way that that paper reporting might be funded. But as the program is currently configured, there just doesn't seem to be any way for ODA to afford paper reporting. So we also have concerns with the other provision of the bill, the changing the location identifier to zip code. Matt's already gone through a lot of that data, a lot of the reasons for that concern. We share those concerns and just believe that changing the location identifier to zip code would virtually eliminate the program's ability to determine where a pesticide was applied. A question that was addressed to Representative Close about the size of the zip codes. Some of the rural Oregon zip codes could be hundreds of square miles in size and cut across multiple watersheds. So I believe it would be virtually impossible to figure out the specific utility of the data on such a large area. And so I would just close by noting that I do think we can all agree that that Oregon needs to have a simple and beneficial pesticide use reporting system. We believe that the legislature and ODA have made great strides in creating such a program and believe that House Bill 2396 will undercut those efforts. And so instead of chipping away at the effectiveness of the current program, I believe we should instead focus our efforts on making it as useful as possible and finding funding for the program. So we would ask that you oppose this bill as it currently stands. So,
thank you, Rep. Members, questions? Hearing none. Welcome, Courtney. For the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Courtney Dresser. I am the Oregon Advocacy Manager for the American Cancer Society. The American Cancer Society was a member of the governor-appointed work group decided to work with ODA on the development of the pesticide use reporting system. We attended the meetings for the entire 18-month duration of that group. We believe that the data from the pesticide use reporting system would be highly beneficial for health researchers working to understand the links between pesticide exposure and cancer. Understanding these links is crucial to preventing cancer and saving lives. At this time, the American Cancer Society has 25 grants in effect dealing with the environment and cancer. These researchers need to have the most specific data available for their research. If the information collected in PERS is not specific, it will be useless for the researchers. The information needs to be collected into the system in the most site-specific manner possible. As a member of the governor's appointed work group, the American Cancer Society supported using even more specific language, such as physical address. We have accepted the outcome of the work group and will support the work group by endorsing using section, township, and range. Zip codes are not specific enough and, as you've heard, vary in size. Researchers agree that information collected for large geographical areas would basically be useless. The American Cancer Society asks that you do not diminish the work group's work by moving this bill out of committee. Public and private researchers need not only to have this information, but it's our obligation to make sure they get the most precise information in order to do their jobs, which is to protect public health and inform Oregonians of any health risk. We ask you not to vote on this bill as it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, do you have questions? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would actually ask all three, because I believe that all three of your organizations were involved in this this work group that was called for in the previous bill. My understanding is that all three of your groups actually were on the losing end of setting the size area. You all three of your groups actually favored a smaller area, but that you're all here to say you will live with the larger area that was recommended by the whole group. Is that, I guess for the record, can I ask if each of you if that's correct?
It is correct for the American Cancer Society, yes. We wanted specific addresses, but we will go with section, township, and range.
For the record, that is also Osprey's position as well.
Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt, yeah, for the record, that's exactly right.
I might
Sure, well, please.
Mr. Chair, with one other question, and this might be best for Matt. You made the correction connected with the California policy, which is apparently by this smaller area of township range section as opposed to a larger county area. I guess, first of all, is that correct? And let me stop there. Go ahead.
Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt, actually, it is by specific location. It's not even by section township range. It's literally by the specific location where you would apply that. So more by specific address.
What do you even call for? If I can follow up with one additional.
Sure.
Last one. One of the, I think, very legitimate concerns that Representative Close raised was related to potential eco-terrorism, harassment by anti-pesticide groups, et cetera. Do you have any information about issues that may have arisen, recognizing that California has a very identifiable system where someone who wanted to commit that kind of terrorism really could zero in? Do you have any information about whether or not that has been an issue in California?
Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt, at this point, this issue has continued to be sort of overshadowing the entire pesticide use reporting program, the confidentiality and some of the perceived threats there. It's something that we've continued to want to work with ODA and the users of the program to address. Our understanding is with the California program, where they do have to have specific reporting requirements, that there has not been a documented case where there's been harassment or any kind of sort of negative behavior due to this program or linked to this program. And I think you can also even look here in Oregon where, in fact, under the Forest Practices Act, we also require specific reporting of pesticide use, and there's been no documented cases there of harassment due to that information being released or being available. So as far as we know and we're aware, there hasn't been any link to that.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the bill's proposal to allow summer use by areas consisting of one or more zip codes, I'm wondering if you're in your opinion, is there anything to prevent, you know, the worst case scenario of the summary of use being reported by, you know, one large zip code consolidating? It says areas consisting of one or more zip codes. Could it potentially be reported as a statewide one zip code?
I mean, it's hard, Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, it's hard to obviously say at this point how it would be interpreted if it was passed, but I think that, you know, given that it's fairly loose in the way it's written there, that one could say that. So, but it's unclear at this point.
So, follow up, Mr. Yep. So, there's you according to the language you see in the bill, you don't see any maximum allowable.
Chair Krupp, no. Representative Worth, not at this point, but again, I think that's going to be an interpretation question.
Thank you.
Okay, a couple of quick questions from me to you, and then, members, we're going to close this public hearing momentarily so that we can open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2260. The chair would ask members that we, on a courtesy basis, we move the ODF&W fee increase bill to Ways and Means today. So that they can continue to massage it down there. And then we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2396 and probably go over just a few minutes. I know some of you will have to leave, but we'll deal with that. So two quick questions for you. You had both said that all of you had said that you really would prefer to have the physical address in terms of part of the reporting system, especially Courtney, from you in terms of the Cancer Society in research, what would that do for you? How would that help you?
Chair, I don't have all the background on this, nor do I know the perspective of a health researcher. So I can come back with some more information, but I'd like to probably would say, I think what people would come up with say is that if we're looking at, especially in Eastern Oregon where a zip code could be 100 square miles, and how a researcher would use that information, the information becomes, I think Representative Byer said, it becomes diluted. How would they be able to then use that information to actually put a link to a pesticide and a health risk like cancer? So from the health researcher's opinion, they basically want to have as much you know, as specific as possible just for them to do their work.
Okay. Either one of you want to answer that?
Just, yeah, Chair Krupp, just a quick response on that. Our understanding from the researchers that we've talked with on this is that, again, it's the more specific the information, the more you're better able to address any concerns and correlations that you might see out there. For example, you might be looking at different hotspots of whether it's different ailments that are popping up in different areas or different, you know, fish kills or different things that could happen with this, or in an airshed context, you could have hot spots of different spikes in air contaminants or air pollution. And by having more specific information, you can see where are the correlation, is there a correlation that we're seeing out there in specific sources that we can zero in on, or is it a broader problem out there? I think, you know, like with air quality things, if you're looking at an airshed, it's a pretty big area, and it's harder if you're just looking at a general assessment of what the pollutants are in that airshed to get a real sense of where the sources are there and how you can deal with that. So I think that's really what the concern is that the broader that information, the less you're able to hone in on where the problems are.
So, but if you're talking about water contamination issues, is part of your concern is that we would identify people who are incorrectly using the products that are out there today, not in accordance with the labels? And you would want that the state would want to know who those people are? Is that a concern at all?
Chair Krupp, I would say that I don't think that the point of having the program is to set up some type of witch hunt to go after folks who are out there misusing or incorrectly using or using in an abundance, you know, things that are causing a harmful effect. I think it's better to give folks a real assessment of where are the areas that we should focus on. You know, are we seeing that in this watershed and stretches, you know, from miles 1 to 3, we have a real problem with a certain pesticide there, and so we need to do more education to folks to encourage folks to use less fertilizer or pesticides on their lawn, things like that. I think that's the kind of aim that we're looking at. It's a better, right now we don't have anything to go on. This will get us the first step there, and then we can talk about what are the ways to try to deal with the data that we do find.
My last question for you would be that since the three of you have indicated that you would prefer to have specific site addresses, and this is a tough question for me to ask, but I'm going to ask it because you've made that assertion in your testimony. That runs contrary to the provisions of the law, so why would you advocate for something, because that then removes the shield of confidentiality, does it not, when you have specific addresses?
Sir Krupp, I would just say that we raised that point to show that compromises had been reached in coming to Section Township Range. I'm not here today advocating that we go in now and change the law to make it more specific, but we would certainly be opposed to making it broader and less useful. So,
very good. Thank the three of you very much. I appreciate it. We're going to recess a public, as I'm so aptly pointed out here, public hearing on House Bill 2396 and open up a public hearing public hearing for the moment.
Sorry. Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, but I want to hear from ODF&W. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2260. Chair would like to call ODF&W forward, if you would, please. Welcome, Lindsay. Director Ball, good to be here today. What do you have for us today?
Chair Krupp and members of the committee, in response to two questions that you asked at the first public hearing on House Bill 2260, we provided you a summary of staffing and vacancy status, and also we gave you a summary of town hall budget meeting notes and comments, as well as a summary of the written comments received in addition to the comments from the meetings. That's the document that you're just now receiving. And if you care for me to expound on that, I certainly can, Chair.
At this point, Director Ball, I would say no. I appreciate the fact that you went to the trouble of putting it together for us.
especially on the individual meetings. We had requested that. And I'll just open it up to members of the committee if you have any additional questions of Director Ball.
I just have one.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Ball, you said 1,000 people. It doesn't look like you're quickly looking. It doesn't look like 1,000 people attended.
Chair Krupp, Representative Smith, there were about 660 people that attended the town hall meetings, and then we received a little over 300 additional comments from people. So that comes out to about 1,000 people who commented or attended town hall meetings.
Matching my emails, I did. Thank you.
And speaking of emails, Representative, these are the emails I've gotten in the last 24 hours.
Oh.
On this issue.
That delete button.
I will admit that I have not had the opportunity to read them as of yet. And so, at any rate, additional questions of the director? Lindsay, you're off easy today. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might just make a very quick comment. It was our endeavor to engage the public in the discussion about this agency's budget. It's a user fee-based agency through the sale of licenses and tags. I must admit I was a little bit taken back by the number of people that came here last Tuesday. I didn't anticipate that much participation, but I guess when you go about business like we did, that definitely caught folks' attention about the agency's budget. I was a little bit shocked by the number of people, but then also impressed that people who hunt and fish in Oregon have quite a passion about the fish and wildlife resource. And I guess that's probably what makes this job as interesting as it is.
Thank you, Director. It's great to see you here. The Chair would like to call Representative Donna Nelson. And then last but not least will be Tillamook County's Les Helgeson whenever Representative Nelson is finished. Welcome, Representative Nelson. As always, you look stellar. Great to have you here. And for the record.
Thank you, Chair Krupp, and wonderful members of this Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. My name is Donna Nelson. I am State Representative from District 24, which encompasses Yamhill County and parts of Polk County. I'm here today to talk about House Bill 2260, in that this is a very strange and arduous situation that I find myself in that I am a fisher, and since we don't have to say man anymore, we can just say fisher, like actor, and a steelheader, and I, you know, certainly have a great appreciation for hunting as well. I'm concerned about the scenario under which this bill was presented, but it probably won't make a difference. But I'd just like to go on record. I have suggested as a member of this committee in listening to the testimony that there are various other ways in which we could handle the issues for which I believe this bill is truly meant to encompass. We could form various types of trusts that could be used for certain purposes. We could designate that the increases in the licenses, including even the outfitters' huge increase, be specified for certain projects within this department. I was just here today simply to ask why this bill could not be amended in a form that would take care of those individuals as listed in Section 3 who are 65 years of age and older and not have the requirement of having to have resided in this state for 50 years prior to the date of application so that they could, you know, fish freely. Likewise, requiring a resident annual senior citizen to pay, half of this fee. An individual who's 70 years of age or older and must have resided in this state for not less than 5 years, I think, is just discriminating. And further, to require that a veteran be a disabled war veteran, to be able to fish free really is just turns my breaks my heart. And I see us moving ahead with this and moving this bill onto Ways and Means. I'm not for an increase. I don't think in this time of a recession we can afford this, when we have residents who really greatly appreciate having $7 back in their kicker to pay their expensive utility fees. Cost of gas is not down. We have proposed increases in gas taxes, in insurance taxes. We approved additional fees and branding. I looked at all of the bills that have been submitted this year, went through every one of them this week, and I'm just astounded to find, you know, that, I mean, it's unbelievable that about over 40% of them are fee increases. Sixty-something percent of them are mandates, and we're charged with, you know, with living within a budget that, you know, is greatly decreased, even with this last forecast. So I'm sad about this, and as some of the individuals, the anglers, all said, you know, Donna, this is taxation with representation. Well, for those who are here, that's great. You know, I'd like to suggest that those individuals with large sums of money go ahead and make their contributions of $500 if they're going to proceed in this. They don't have to just pay $19 for a hunting license to hunt a resident. License to hunt wildlife, or $73 for non-resident. I mean, you know, if all the anglers and the hunters have this much money, you know, let them go ahead and make tremendous contributions without us making it a mandate. And once again, I'd just like to alert the fact that we make this increase this year, and we'll be making the next one, when we've not as yet even looked at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife budget, which includes a tremendous increase in the compensation for those who run this agency. Not that they're not worth it, but simply that we've all had to, you know, pull together, and with a moratorium on additional salary increases for this biennium. We're down $1 billion, and right, you know, here's some funding potential. But it should not occur without us correcting the excess spending that's already listed in the Department of Fish and Wildlife budget. I like them a lot. I appreciate all they do. I appreciate how they protect us in our right to have this great sport fishing and hunting activity, our activities. At this time, I just want to speak against it.
Thank you, Representative. I might suggest that the issues that you brought up in regards to the pioneer angling license and the residency issues and those types of things, those are some pretty in-depth policy discussions, and I would encourage you, outside of the context of this bill, to consider drafting legislation to address those concerns of yours. That is a whole other can of worms for us to open up, and it's probably not appropriate for us to do it in this particular fee bill. And I have to tell you that I share many of your concerns, and my vote today in favor of moving this bill out of this committee down to the Ways and Means is only as a courtesy vote. I reserve the right to vote against this legislation on the floor should I choose to do so, and your thoughts are well taken, Representative, because I share many of those sentiments.
Thank you, members of the committee and Chair Krupp.
Thank you. And the chair would like to call Les Helgeson. Les, are you here? Okay. At this point, we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2260 and open a work session on House Bill 2260. Members, this bill will have an amendment probably brought forth either down in Ways and Means, or perhaps on the Senate side in terms of this discussion of a policy issue. And it has to do with the outfitter deer and elk tag issue. I think we heard from the guides and packers about that, expressing some concern. They're working on that issue. They'll have an amendment. I felt it appropriate that we move the legislation forward
in its current manner. They've received the appropriate assurances they'll be able to deal with that adequately in terms of amending the bill in another location in this building. So, with that, the chair would entertain a motion to recommend this legislation to the House Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I move that we move House Bill 2260 to Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Okay. Members, it has been moved. We move House Bill 2260 to the Ways and Means Subcommittee by prior reference. And for the record, members, I would prefer, unless you want to discuss this further, that we make no recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means at this time. Now, those are my thoughts, and we'll have Representative Smith and then Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Chair Krupp. I just want to go on record. I'll give you a courtesy vote to move this, but I have some real deep concerns about raising fees on people who hunt and fish. Just because you attended town hall, many people that I have talked to did not even know vote no on the floor, too, if the budget issues aren't addressed.
Thank you. Representative Byer?
I just have a process question. I am new to the process, and you'd think I'd watched it enough to know, but once we send this to Ways and Means, does it go back to the Senate committee?
That is correct. Thank you. Representative Hunt?
I guess just to share a somewhat different perspective, I would actually affirm Representative Nelson's call for an active review of the department, because I think that's very much within our purview, and I hope we do pursue that on a separate track. I guess as I look at this bill, I don't think this is a judgment one way or another on the effective spending within ODF&W. I think it is a statement that, and I think we should send a statement, when an agency and a set of industry groups are able to work together and actually come up with, it doesn't even sound like a compromise. I mean, it's an enthusiastic recommendation. I think that's something we need to affirm. I wish that kind of process happened more, because often an agency and industry groups will come back and have a different perspective at the end of a process. So I guess I just want to go on record really commending ODF&W and the whole range of industry groups who are willing to stand up and say these are important state services, that they're not even trying to go after general fund dollars, but are willing to stand up and say that they're willing to support these services and to maintain these key staff who are going to regulate them, but also assist them in being more successful in their business and in their support endeavors as well. So I would be very supportive of this motion, and I would be very supportive of sending it on with a due pass recommendation, but we may not have the votes to do that today.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go on record as saying I fully support this bill. I think that the outpouring of public input we heard, regardless if it was at town halls or multitude of emails or the folks sitting in the audience, that's certainly much more input than I generally get on issues, even coming from Corvallis. So, I want to remind and say for the record that the increases proposed in this bill will simply bring our fees in line with the average of surrounding and neighboring states. And that, you know, the input that we get from the public directly impacts, I believe, the quality of our decision makings, and particularly the signed petitions that were brought by Mr. Dunn of Tillamook and the informal poll of the customers of the sporting goods store that was owned by Mr. Hathaway in Roseburg, and then all the people in the audience that they clearly, resoundingly told us that hatcheries, local fish biologists, outreach programs, and law enforcement were entirely important enough to basically impose fees upon themselves. And to and this bill certainly does it, you know, retains the important services that the public has identified, and does so in a way that does not depend on general fund monies, nor does it increase taxes. So for those reasons, I am fully supportive of this bill and would recommend a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Gilman, do you have anything to add?
A real quick one.
Sure.
Courtesy vote to get this bill out. I have to visit with more of my sports persons in my district before I'll determine how my vote will be on the floor.
Okay. Members, the motion on the table is without recommendation to refer this bill to Ways and Means. If there's sentiment in the committee to change that to a do pass, then we would have to have Representative Nelson withdraw her motion. And I think I would just take a quick poll of members of the committee. How do you feel individually about do pass? We've heard from two of you.
It would be a do pass.
Okay. Representative Nelson, how do you feel?
No.
And myself, no. So we'll move the... okay. The motion is as it is. And so with no further discussion, David, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Ward.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye. House Bill 2260 is hereby referred to the Ways and Means Subcommittee without recommendation as to passage. And we'll close a work session on House Bill 2260. Members, if you can spend a few minutes here, would greatly appreciate it. I have to attend another meeting. I'm going to pass the gavel to Vice Chair Gilman, who will reopen a public hearing and take testimony on House Bill 2396.
Thank you, Chair Krupp.
Mr. Chair.
Reopen the hearing on House Bill 2396 and tell it
Katie
Fast.
For the record, Katie Fast representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I will try to be brief since you're running over. 2396 brings two concerns that the ranching industry has regarding pesticide use reporting to the front. The first is confidentiality. By increasing the size of the reporting location, it will ease much of the concern that the user groups have. That concern is being pinpointed by township, range, and section, while still keeping the information useful as collected. There is a concern much of our membership has properties that are at 1 square mile or are the only operation within that area. The second concern is the difficulty to comply with the law and to fill out the reports. Even in this high-tech range, not all of our ranching and farming communities have a computer with internet access, nor do they know how to use a computer as well. This requires, with the current program, to have somebody else enter confidential information over the internet for them. And this is a huge concern with our industry, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Katie. Any questions? Yes.
Yes. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you agree that the compliance with the current law is now, is there any difficulty complying with the current law is in terms of funding? I mean,
Chair Gilman, Representative Worth, yes, there is problems right now. We have members who have tried to enter in their information over the internet, and the system has crashed on them. They've made multiple calls to the department trying to answer their questions. I think this also comes to a bigger question right now with our budget constraints is this program necessary or is this just a want? And I feel that our membership is saying that this program is kind of a want. We're not really getting a lot of useful information from it right now. And possibly it's time for some of that money to go to education, police control, the areas are being cut, and then bring this program back into a full running program that will not crash on people, will be able to
put together a useful report for all the industry groups at a later time when our state has some extra budgetary money.
Call it, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, Representative.
Well, since you agree then that compliance with the law is mainly problematic due to funding, could these modifications then proposed in this bill specifically be more appropriately considered once full funding is, according to the law, implemented and the system that is prescribed by the law is actually up and running?
Chair Gilman, Representative Worth, I think that's a hard question to answer because right now you have two issues. You have one, a program via internet that is not up and running and is not user-friendly community group. And then the second issue is that people are unable to comply. They do not have the tools necessary in their home, on their business, to comply with the law. And when Oregon, the government, puts in a law, they should also put in the ability for people to comply with it. And the cattlemen believe that the pesticide use reporting is not a system that allows people to comply with the law.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair calls Brad Witt and Terry Witt.
I'll wait for Brad.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Brad Witt, Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I was also a member of the House Bill 3602 work group, which Representative Hunt referenced earlier. Our organization has 180,000 working men and women across this state, and we are appearing today in opposition to House Bill 2396. And in the interest of brevity, I will attempt to summarize my prepared statement. House Bill 2396 threatens the safety and health of workers by making the scale of reporting so large that the data actually becomes meaningless. In my prepared statement, I reference a litany of workers who may regularly be exposed to pesticides while on the job, and I also detail some of the debilitating effects that pesticide poisonings bring to human beings. Our main concern here is the post-application phase of pesticide usage, where workers would unknowingly be exposed to pesticide hotspots, and consequently, because they don't know that the hotspot exists, do not take prudent protective actions. Now, we had hoped as an organization to use the information reported under House Bill 3602 to develop a set of protocols to protect workers' safety and health. In essence, the protocols would have said, if you work in the following areas, particularly during certain times of the years, then it would be prudent, we would recommend that you take the following protections to possibly guard against exposure to pesticides. But House Bill 2396 precludes the development of these protocols because the scale is too large. Simply put, if you're to tell someone to take protections against pesticides because they've been used in a given zip code, 97, fill in the last three blanks, it's unworkable. I give to you the example of my own community, Klatskanai. One zip code, our entire community. There is simply no way that we can protect workers' safety and health by telling them, you know, there were pesticides that were used in zip code 97016. You ought to take necessary precautions. It's meaningless. Workers' safety and health will be seriously jeopardized, I hope that you can see, by House Bill 2396, and we urge your opposition to this bill on that basis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies first. Is that what you said? Representative Hunt, thank you. Brad, or Mr. Chair, Chair Gilman and Brad, I don't want to keep everybody here forever, but I want you to please give me your current operating program, how you currently handle this among these 180,000 members. This isn't something brand new. I know this because I've been in the industrial side. You know that. So would you put mind to have someone prepare that? Because I want to know how you're currently handling situations where you're dealing with this.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Mr. Chairman, that is precisely the problem. Post-application phase, there are no safeguards because there's no knowledge. You don't know where those hot spots exist. And that is precisely the problem that we are attempting to guard against.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Brad, you have to. I mean, these people right now, I mean, whether it's OSHA or whatever else it is, I mean, these 180,000 people aren't just working in the workplace without any type of protection. And, I mean, I was in a business where we were, you know, spraying chemicals and all sorts of things to prevent these gypsy moths and spruce budworms, and I know this well. So I'm just, we're all of a sudden, we're acting like this has never been done, and we already report it. We already know, you know, what the exposure is. We had, I mean, we've been reporting for, well, it's longer than that. I was going to say 25 years. It's 30 since 1960, so woo. That's a lot of years on all the chemicals, pesticides, and the insecticides that we've used. So why all of a sudden, you know, we're acting like these guys aren't protected, and guys and girls. And I know we do have reporting because you couldn't even be in business right now.
Representative, this has been a longstanding problem. That's precisely what our interest was in this legislation. While pesticides are being applied, there are safety and health protections and protocols in existence. During the application phase, we're not arguing that there's a lack of knowledge. It's post-application phase. The pesticide has been applied, and subsequent to that, workers are called into an area to perform various kinds of work, and they have no basis upon which to even know that that area is a hot spot to begin with. Thus, they have no reason to think that they would have to be taking certain precautions that there is even a hot spot in existence. That's the problem. Post-application.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I just why don't you come talk to me?
Okay.
You know, I don't want to belabor this. I mean, I think you have a responsibility to know that, and for your people, just like every businessman, you know, every farmer does, every helicopter operator, and you know, we know it where it is. I mean, it was our business to know it, or we weren't doing our job. So,
thank you, Representative. I appreciate your support.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Witt, I recognize the pesticide stakeholder work group. You may not have a list. We've actually never talked about who was actually part of this group. If you don't have a list in front of you, maybe you could just share off the top of your head a sense of the type of groups that were part of this work group that actually recommended the that had consensus around at least a range of smaller areas, much smaller than the zip code.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, the work group was divided evenly between pesticide users and the users of the information that would be generated, so that in terms of the user group, interests that would be applying pesticides, as well as folks whose land perhaps those pesticides were applied on. The other nine, the users, potential data users on the end, included environmental organizations, organized labor, public health. That's a pretty good start, anyways.
So am I correct in my understanding that this diverse group, labor, environment, industry, landowners, that there was within that group agreement at least that it would that there would be use of an area of township ranger section or smaller? That there was, at the end of the process, everyone was agreeing that that the area to be considered would be that size or smaller.
That is correct, Representative Hunt. The debate was on the merits of quarter section versus sectional based reporting. Those were the parameters.
One last follow-up. I may be safe in assuming that you actually advocated for a smaller area than actually came out to be the net consensus of the group, but yet, am I correct that you are nevertheless supporting the group?
I was on the losing end of that vote, but yes, was supportive of the decision that the group made. Correct.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, Brad.
Thank you.
And I call Mel Pullen.
I'm Terry Wood. Now I'll come up.
Oh, okay.
Left over with.
didn't want to get you confused with between Brad and myself, or former Representative Bill Witt. Good afternoon. My name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'll keep my comments brief, too. Try to keep time down as minimal as possible. Unlike the other folks that have testified today, I've been involved in this issue personally since almost day one. I was the chief author of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3602, which eventually became the Bee and Gross version, which was passed and signed by the governor. I also was, as was Brad Witt, a actual member of the task force that participated in the, I guess you would call it, the stakeholders work group. I need to, I think, preface some of my remarks by saying that this is a very contentious issue. I think you probably realize that, but it still is a very big leap of faith for many of the farm community to accept this program. I mean, it basically, we're asking them to put some confidentiality on the line that for things that could, in essence, take away tools that they need in order to operate a successful, profitable business. And it scares the hell out of them, to be very frank with you. And that's where a lot of the acrimony is coming from. People who have been on the attacked side of some of these issues and are fighting for their lives out in the countryside, as I'm sure you're well aware. Getting back to the bill, I'm trying to cut to the chase. The bill basically, as it is proposed, does three things. The first change is that it changes the reporting limit or the identifier for location to that of zip code. Now, one thing that has not been mentioned is that while there is current reporting requirement for Township Range Section, that does not pertain to commercial applicators within the city. Commercial applicators within the city report by zip code. This was done in order to facilitate those people specifically that will do somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30,000 applications a year, to facilitate them grouping their applications together so that they can report similar applications during a consistent time period within a zip code. And I think, as everyone has pretty much been in agreement with, the size of or area of a zip code really varies from across the state. If you take, for instance, the 97310 zip code, which is the state capital area, I think it's a couple miles across. If you go to the zip code that is the zip code for Burns, it's almost 80 miles across. So you have tremendous variation in terms of the geographic area that a zip code would cover. But I think it's safe to say that in most populated areas, because zip codes are based upon population, that populated areas have fairly well-defined, relatively small areas. So that works extremely well. The concern over confidentiality is one that is of prime importance to the agricultural community. As I said before, this is their livelihood that's at stake. For folks to be basically putting their life on the line, so to speak, as they say, betting the farm, is kind of the term a lot of them will use. That's a big order to ask for. So there has been and there always will be a push to try to make the geographic location as large as possible to provide meaningful data, small enough to provide meaningful data, but yet large enough to provide some anonymity to the folks that are reporting inside of it. I'll get back to the question, Representative, that you had asked before about the consensus in the group, because I would like to address that, that pertains to Township Range Section. Change 2 is one that strikes the July 1, 2003 deadline for the department to provide its first summary report, and it basically replaces that, I think, with some wording that says provide annual reports. And it talks about it being in areas consistent with one or more zip code. I think, again, that's another debate. The same debate holds true whatever you decide for a geographic location, obviously, would carry over into how you're going to report this. But I think one of the important things to consider at this point in time is it is not possible for the department to meet that July 1, 2003 deadline. The current system, the current PURS system, is in a temporary mode. It is not finished. It is not capable of handling all of the data from a year's worth of application, number one. Number two, it's been defined as a great big black file drawer in which you put things, but you cannot retrieve things. So the department, while things are going into this black box, the department doesn't know what's going into it, nor do they have the ability to retrieve it. So whatever data is in the temporary system is totally useless from the standpoint of any kind of reporting mechanism. So even if the department wanted to and had the money to do a report, they don't have any data to do a report with. So I think something has to be done in order to eliminate or relieve the department from this requirement, that it's one that they can't fulfill. And then last, the proposed bill also changes or provides for a paper form of submitting reports. OFS also agrees that's a viable option and something we should look at. It was looked at when the bill was first introduced in 1999, and I believe back then the estimate that was given to the legislature was about 1.2 million per biennium for running a paper system, and the biggest share of that was the cost of taking information from a hard copy and entering it into a database, because having just on paper doesn't do you any good if you can't manipulate or compare the data. So the data would have to then be entered, and the cost of data entry was extremely high, even using labor at the state corrections. It was still going to be in excess of $1 million per biennium. So it was clipped, not because it was considered to be not a good idea to have paper reporting. It was clipped off simply because there was no money. The funding was barely there to develop a program and try to get it up and implement it, and there really was not an additional $1 million, roughly speaking, to spend just to do data entry. So I think what I would recommend is that the department be asked to put together a very detailed fiscal analysis of what it would cost to do paper reporting, and allow the legislature to look at that and make an informed decision as to whether or not this is a viable option that you want to add on to pesticide use reporting, or whether it's one that's simply at this point in time not appropriate from a cost perspective. If I could digress just for a second and go back to the concept or the question regarding the task force. When we started that task force, and I'll call it negotiations because that's really what it was, we had a facilitator. And it started out, it was pretty much a confrontational kind of situation, as you can imagine. There's nine on one side, nine on the other. It was agreed early on in the process that we would go through all of the parts of the pesticide use reporting bill, and that no one would be held to a decision, an interim decision that was made along the way. Otherwise, we'd never get through the whole process. The reason being that, obviously, what you decide to do in, let's say, determining if an address was going to be used is going to obviously have an impact when you get to the tail end when you're talking about confidentiality. So what you decide up front may well have to be revisited or may have to be modified in the end. So we made an agreement that, for sake of moving the process along, we would periodically try to get consensus, and if not, we'd take a vote. If we couldn't get unanimous consent, we would take a vote. And then we would move on. The area of location was one of those situations where we did not get unanimous consensus. We had to take votes, and we had to take several votes, as a matter of fact, before we were able to get to the point where, shall we say, one side won and the other one didn't. And matter of fact, if I recall correctly, there were several times when revotes were asked for because certain parties weren't available in one particular meeting. In the next meeting, the power, the shift of it's just like the legislature, you know, the power majority shifted, and all of a sudden you'd ask for a revote. So to say that things that were discussed in the task force were in fact the end recommendation of the task force, I think, is a little bit disingenuous at this point in time. Secondly, the output of the task force was just that. It was a recommendation to go to rulemaking, which then would go to for public comment. The bottom line is the public comment process was the ultimate feedback that was going to be used for determining the rules to implement pesticide use reporting. And the rulemaking process came back and clearly recommended that reporting be done on a watershed basis. The hearings officer made that recommendation. The Department of Agriculture made that recommendation. The Board of Agriculture made that recommendation. There was only one person that stopped it, and that was the governor. The governor said, no, it will be section, township, range. And that was the end of the conversation. So there still is a divided jury on this, and there still is a lot of acrimony. But, you know, the camps are still holding their own from a standpoint of their position. One last comment I'd like to make. Many people confuse the purpose of pesticide use reporting and confuse what it can or can't be used to accomplish. And I think Representative Nelson had made some very pointed comments that we have a variety of laws, including worker protection standards and or OSHA and number of other standards that are designed specifically to protect workers against pesticides, not only on the job, but pesticides after they've been applied in the fields. And to say that there are hot pesticide hot spots out there, well, then that's a matter for the U.S. EPA and DEQ to be dealing with, because if these are hot spots, they're probably orphan sites that need to be cleaned up. But we do have very, very specific laws that protect workers, give them the right to know this material is posted, it remains posted, fields remain posted. So it's not a big black mystery, as some would have the whole area of pesticides be painted. The purpose of pesticide use reporting was to provide a system by which we could look at use, determine patterns, and help us determine what kind of monitoring we needed to do, primarily to make sure that the health of our environment was being protected. And that's why watersheds became such a viable entity as far as location, because every other regulatory and monitoring program that we have in the state right now dealing with particularly water and in the environment is dealt with on a watershed basis. And so the idea was, doesn't it make sense that if we're doing monitoring and we're doing collection of data and summarization of data, that we do that on the same geographic unit or size area that other regulatory agencies are doing monitoring on, so that we can compare apples and apples rather than apples and oranges. With that, I've already used up probably more time than I should have. Be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Witt, given the fact that millions of dollars have been spent and invested to date to design the PERS system according to specifications very different than those proposed in this bill, what, in your estimate, would it cost to implement the changes suggested in this bill before us?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Worth, I have no idea what the cost of implementing these changes would be. I would not, with the exception of the paper reporting, which I believe, you know, I've heard now estimates anywhere from, what, $700,000 to, in my estimate, recollection from two sessions ago was like $1.2 million. The other aspects I don't think would require any additional dollar expenditure. The big problem that we have right now is that the remaining dollars that were originally earmarked for development of the program and placed within the emergency board were not released to the department to allow them to complete the permanent database. So we're lacking now, and I believe the correct term is about $270,000 is what we're lacking right now for the contractor to finish converting from a temporary to a permanent database that would allow not only input of all the data but retrieval of the data. It would allow for electronic transfer. That's one of the other problems we have right now. Many of our operators do a considerable amount of pesticide application. They can only enter that right now on a screen-by-screen basis. In other words, one application on a screen, enter it, bring the screen back up, put another application, enter it. You cannot put together a spreadsheet and download the whole thing electronically, which would make sense. The permanent system will allow electronic transfer of the information. So there's a lot of efficiencies that will be or could be enjoyed if we had the permanent system. So I think the first question is, when or how can we finish the system so that we can at least have a system that operates?
So follow up, Mr. Chair. So are you advocating for full funding of the original system as soon as possible by the legislature?
I would like to see, I personally, Vice Chair, would like to see the system finish, yes.
Okay, and final follow-up. And if you were to find out that the fiscal impact of the changes proposed in this bill was significant, would you still advocate for this bill's passage?
Madam Vice Chair, I'm not sure we have enough money to complete it as it is right now. Looking for additional money would be that much more difficult.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Yes. Representative.
Mr. Wood, I appreciate you coming out and very much appreciate the folks, the recognition that your members are scared. It's something new. It's something different. It's additional. It's additional regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So that can be a challenging process. And I also, having been through those kind of negotiation consensus building processes, I know that those are not particularly enjoyable for the participants. So
right.
I commend you for participating in that. But I guess I'm left confused because some of the earlier testimony we had reported out what were consensus recommendations, at least in those areas, where, reading from one of the previous testimonies, where nine of the work group members, including all the pesticide user groups, voted for a town range section, and five voted for an area that was four times smaller, and nobody voted for a zip code. I guess help me reconcile that with your.
It's very, Vice Chair, Representative Hunt. That's very easy to explain. When your two choices are, would you like section township range, or would you like quarter section township range? If those are your two choices, which would you take? You take the bigger of the two, and that's really where we were at in the process.
Well, Mr. Chair, the process of getting to that decision involved a series. I assume it wasn't a decision, a choice that was imposed by the facilitator. It was a choice that was imposed by the group on itself by narrowing down options through a series of stages of negotiation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hutt, it was a combination of both. And the bottom line, again, was that we were going through a series of decisions. It was not a single decision. And we were really bogged down. I mean, I think this was, the location was probably single most, probably the biggest, the toughest one to deal with. And it was one of the first ones that we tried to tackle. And we knew that if we stayed on this one, we'd be there for not 18 meetings, but probably 118 meetings. And to be very frank with you, from my perspective, representing the user community, we just at that point said, take a vote, do whatever you want. It's not a cast in concrete recommendation. That was going out for, we knew it was going out for rulemaking at that point in time. And it was not a consensus of the group, by the way. And I'd be glad to look up the minutes on that. But I think if you read the minutes in their entirety, it was not a consensus opinion.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Terry.
I might just add, Representative, that you know, regardless of what the task force recommended, again, those were recommendations to go into the rulemaking process, which then goes into the public process. And from my perspective, the public process is one that perhaps even should have more weight than a group of 18 people saying they represent everyone in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
And now, Mel Fullen.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Oregon Department of Human Services, and I work in public health there. And I know the hour is late. I'm going to be very brief. You have my written testimony, and I think that most of the arguments that I was going to recount have already been made quite articulately and discussed in a variety of ways. So I guess basically what I'd like to say is that I'm here to represent the department and oppose this bill because, first of all, pesticide use reporting is important for us to be able to evaluate public health risks associated with pesticide exposure. And we feel that this bill, because it decreases the geographic specificity of the data, would make it much less useful for us. In addition, as has already been said, allowing the paper reports would make the system much more cumbersome, slower, and more expensive. And so I just want to add my voice to that. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you. I close the hearing on House Bill 2396. And I don't believe there's anything else. We're adjourned.
Just a tad.